From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Melissa Block. BP's blown-out well in the Gulf of Mexico is now filled with heavy fluid, and that has effectively shut off the flow of oil up from the reservoir more than 2 miles below the seabed. Today at the White House, National Incident Commander Thad Allen had this to say about the events of the past 24 hours.
It's a consequential day. We've significantly reduced the threat of hydrocarbons into the environment that have plagued us for a long, long time.
The federal government also issued a report today that tries to account for the 4.9 million barrels of oil that spilled into the Gulf following the Deepwater Horizon disaster on April 20th. That report leaves a lot of questions. First and foremost, just how much of that oil is still lingering in the marshes and the deeper waters of the Gulf. NPR's Richard Harris has the story.
This morning, before the report was released, White House energy aide Carol Browner made the rounds of the morning TV shows. There, she boasted that the oil was largely taken care of and no longer a big threat to the coastlines. Here she is on NBC's Today Show.
More than three-quarters of the oil is gone. The vast majority of the oil is gone. It was captured, it was skimmed, it was burned, it was contained. Mother Nature did her part, and that's good news.
Good news if you forget for a moment that even one quarter of the oil from the spill still represents about 5 Exxon Valdez's worth. But it turns out the actual report, issued later in the morning, isn't nearly so upbeat. At a White House briefing, government scientist Jane Lubchenco dialed back the success figure from Browner's 75%.
At least 50% of the oil that was released is now completely gone from the system, and most of the remainder is degrading rapidly or is being removed from the beaches.
So that means there are about 10 Exxon Valdez's worth of oil that could be out in the Gulf. This includes oil that's on the marshes, buried under the sand, floating as a light sheen in a few places still, but also a large volume of oil that's still way out deep under the ocean. Lubchenco, who heads the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, says that oil is now gradually being eaten up by microbes in the Gulf, but the oil that remains can't simply be dismissed.
Oil that is in microscopic droplets that is still there may be toxic to any of the small creatures under the water that it encounters.
And although it won't be in the water forever, Ira Leifer from the University of California at Santa Barbara expects it will take years for it to disappear.
One would expect that of the oil that was dispersed and dissolved, that probably about 5 to 10% would likely have been biodegraded at this point.
Meaning that 90% of it is still there in the water. And while it's great having nature playing a central role in breaking down the oil that's in the water, John Kessler from Texas A&M University says, beware.
It's kind of a double-edged sword here.
In the process of removing oil from the waters, these microbes also consume large amounts of oxygen. And out in the deep waters of the Gulf where this is going on, Kessler and colleagues are seeing areas where oxygen levels are dropping substantially, say 20 to 40%.
And while that sounds significant, and it is, harmful effects normally occur once you've got about a two-thirds reduction.
And since there's plenty of oil left yet to be eaten up in the Gulf, those oxygen levels could go lower. Kessler adds another wrinkle to this. About half the hydrocarbons that came out of the well weren't oil, but in the form of natural gas, and that, too, depletes oxygen.
This report does not address the gas at all. It doesn't mention it one bit.
And here's something else curious about the report. Despite the very high-profile flotilla of skimmers out in the Gulf of Mexico, the report says they managed to remove a paltry 3% of the oil. Ira Leifer at Santa Barbara has a few ideas about why that's the case. First of all, he says the widespread use of chemical dispersants at the surface managed to make the oil sink down a few inches or feet below the waterline, which put it out of reach of the skimmers. Leifer says the slicks were also just plain hard to find.
The spill was so extensive that it was not possible for it to be effectively surveyed on any one day by aircraft to spot where to direct skimmers. And currently, the satellite platforms are not able to tell anyone where thick oil is as opposed to where a thin sheen is.
National Incident Commander Thad Allen agrees that there are important lessons yet to be learned from the way they attacked this spill, including hard questions about the interplay of dispersants and skimmers.
I think when we're all done, we're going to have to go back and say, moving forward as we create an inventory of response tools, what really served us best in this response?
One lesson we've already learned is that it's dangerous to declare victory too soon. So Allen keeps stressing that the situation with the well won't be fully in hand until the well is plugged with cement. and that's likely to be a few weeks away. Richard Harris, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Michelle Norris.
And I'm Alyssa Block. The personal Bible of Joseph Smith, the founder of the Mormon faith, has turned up for sale. Asking price, a cool $1.5 million. Before the Bible finds a new home, a Salt Lake City bookstore threw open its doors so the public could sneak a peek. From member station KUER in Salt Lake City, Jenny Brundine reports.
At Ken Sanders' Rare Books, beat poetry nights and parties celebrating Sanders' friend, the late anarchist and novelist Edward Abbey, are regular happenings. But a special book is bringing in a new set of customers. Ken Sanders opens a locked glass case for a better look at a Bible from 1831. It belonged to the founder of what's been described as America's most famous homegrown faith, Mormonism, also known as the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Collectors knew Joseph Smith Jr.'s family Bible was out there somewhere. Sanders recalls his reaction when the anonymous owner approached him to take it on consignment.
Raised eyebrows. This is interesting. In our business, you know, you always love to see something you've never seen before. And this is like a living historical artifact to the very foundations of the LDS Church.
Tucked in the Bible are Smith family genealogies featuring Joseph and his first wife Emma's handwriting. They include the only correct birth and death dates for a seventh son who was never named. Experts authenticated the Bible and its origins.
And I had to ascertain that it didn't have any taint of Mark Hoffman about it.
Mark Hoffman was one of the 20th century's most notorious forgers of literature and Mormon documents, turning to bombs and murder to cover up his forgeries. He's now serving a life sentence here.
These were inside of the Bible.
The real deal, Smith's Bible, is drawing a steady stream of history buffs into Sanders' shop. Most are Mormon, and they're quiet as they look reverently at the sacred text of the man they consider a prophet.
Yeah, you can't touch it, but to be that close and see the handwriting, and it's very awe-inspiring.
Michael Cox showed up on a lunch break for a rare glimpse at the tattered and water-stained Bible. Paul Savage, who spent at least an hour milling about, says the book represents more than one family's personal belief.
This is of premier importance to everybody. It's an amazingly rare artifact to be put out on the market, and hopefully it goes to a good place.
Bookseller Ken Sanders believes the Bible belongs with the Mormon Church, but says the owner isn't in a position to donate it. Kurt Bench, a dealer specializing in Mormon books, calls the $1.5 million price tag stunning.
It would be an incredible possession for somebody today, and it really will be interesting to see just what someone is willing to pay for that book.
Today's the last day to catch a glimpse of the Bible. It will be locked away for safekeeping tonight. For NPR News, I'm Jenny Brundine in Salt Lake City.
Author J. Courtney Sullivan has been revisiting an adolescent reading obsession about first love. To this day, Sullivan confesses that she can still reread it in a single sitting and enjoy every single page. Her confession is part of our series, My Guilty Pleasure, where authors recommend a book they're embarrassed to love.
In fifth grade, I was a member of an all-girls book club. We met by the tetherball court during recess and read novels aloud. Okay, just the dirty parts. By seventh grade, the book club had disbanded. That was the year I discovered Forever. The author was Judy Blume. It was 1993. I didn't know then that Forever had caused an uproar when it was released in 1975, or that some people called it smut, or that it would go on to be one of the most banned books in America. Had I realized this, I would have read it much sooner. Once I turned the first page, I was hooked. It was the narrator Catherine's description of a boy at a party that did it. My name's Fred. I live next door to Sybil. I'm a freshman at Dartmouth. Catherine continues, unfortunately, he was also a creep. At the same party, she meets Michael, a fellow high school senior. They fall in love. There is not a hint of dot, dot, dot here. Catherine and Michael talk explicitly about their sexual desires. The resulting bedroom scenes are as detailed as any clueless adolescent girl could hope for. I read Forever in a single sitting, sometime between my first crush and my first kiss. I was under the covers with a flashlight, listening for footsteps on the stairs. There is real, awkward, friendly intimacy between the main characters in Forever. I am 28 now, and I know couples my age who can't communicate as well about their hopes, their fears, their families, and their foreplay. What shocks me is that in the age of sexting, Bristol Palin, and online porn, Forever is still considered controversial. At its core, it's about female teenagers who make responsible birth control choices, who, when they're ready, have sex on their own terms instead of for the gaze or approval of men. What's so shocking about that? I may have come for the scandal, but I stayed for the feminist lesson. While rereading Forever on the subway recently, I could feel the guy beside me skimming over my shoulder. I glanced at him. He gave me a strange look. I hardly cared.
J. Courtney Sullivan is the author of Commencement.
This is NPR. The for-profit education industry has been exploding in size, doubling over the past decade and soaking up billions in federal student aid. Well, today a Senate committee heard evidence that some for-profits encourage students to lie so they'll qualify for those government dollars. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
The tactics revealed in a federal investigation sound like they come from the annals of the used car industry. The Government Accountability Office sent people posing as applicants into for-profit college recruiting offices. Using hidden cameras, the would-be students captured recruiters leaning on them to sign an admissions form. One pretend student asked to speak with a financial aid officer at ATI Career Training Center in Texas. The student practically begs the recruiter to give him some idea of how much money he'll owe before signing up to pay $38,000 in tuition.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping your financial people could say, all right, here's your total loans and here's how much your
payments are. Yeah, they're going to be able to do that when you get back there, but they're really not going to be able to sit down and go over everything with you if you're not willing to reserve your seat.
She keeps pushing him to sign the enrollment form. One recruiter even brought his director out of a back room to tighten the screws. While some of the ploys illustrated are merely slimy, others are probably illegal. Greg Kutz, who conducted the investigation for the Government Accountability Office, says some would-be students were told not to report financial assets on their application for federal aid.
Other students were told to add bogus dependents to their federal aid form. One representative held up three fingers and told us specifically to add three bogus dependents to our federal aid form.
Kutz is referring some of the evidence for possible prosecution. For nearly two decades, it's been illegal to offer cash awards for boosting enrollment, but another witness at the hearing described a hothouse, high-pressure atmosphere on his sales floor. Joshua Prine was a sales rep for Alta College in Denver, where he says bells would ring each time a student signed up.
Each representative had a quota of two students to enroll per week. Individual enrollments could mean paid time off or gift cards, and a successful year in the top representatives and all expenses paid trip to Cancun.
The GAO did find that some schools did give out accurate information some of the time, telling students, for example, it's not possible to guarantee earnings after graduation. But of 15 schools investigators visited, all gave some questionable or deceptive advice. The career college industry has sometimes claimed in the past that reports of abusive recruiting are the excesses of a few rogue individuals. But today, Harris Miller of the Career College Association said he could not defend what he saw in those tapes.
There was no doubt that the government itself, the federal government, the state government, and the accrediting bodies, which in turn are approved by the federal government, are going to have to get more aggressive.
The Government Accountability Office says there's no clear need for new regulation or legislation since many of the practices revealed today are illegal or clearly against accrediting guidelines. One lawmaker said the same spotlight should be trained on nonprofit institutions. Republican Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina said in his state, students at many for-profit schools are more likely to graduate with a degree than those at nonprofit colleges.
So I share this with my colleagues to let them know the label of for-profit or the label for nonprofit has no specific impact on graduation rates.
The reason Congress is so concerned is that these schools depend heavily on federal money for their revenue. For-profit students are also more likely to borrow more than they can repay, leaving taxpayers on the hook. The Department of Education is considering tighter regulations on for-profits, but these videos seem to indicate the existing rules are not being enforced. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to All Things Considered.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Alyssa Blanc.
And I'm Michelle Norris. Many economists say the U.S. won't fully recover from the recession until the housing market recovers. But the number of homeowners facing foreclosure continues to rise. And as NPR's Anthony Brooks reports, the foreclosure crisis is now deepening in states like Massachusetts, places that were initially spared the worst of the real estate collapse.
Paul Collier is an attorney in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who represents homeowners facing foreclosure. Collier says these days he's busier than ever.
The financial conditions that created this meltdown and the legal conditions that created the meltdown are still there.
Last month, banks took more than 1,300 Massachusetts homes, more than double the rate of the same period last year. That according to Timothy Warren, CEO of the Warren Group, who tracks real estate in Massachusetts.
Foreclosures are at high levels right now. People are entering foreclosure at a very high rate. And, you know, that indicates a certain level of economic distress and that we're probably going to be facing that for some period of time.
The historically high foreclosure rates are due in part to banks working extra hard to get those non-performing loans off their books. In other words, they want to close out the bad loans and resell the homes to people who can afford them. Beyond that, Aaron Gornstein, who heads an affordable housing advocacy group in Boston, says the unemployment rate remains stubbornly high.
People are losing their jobs or have reduced work hours. We have a lot of people in the construction trades that are unemployed, close to 40%. So those people are falling behind in their mortgage. They can't keep up. And as a result, they're going into foreclosure.
Joel Searby agrees and says the high foreclosure rate has more to do with a tough economy than with the fallout from the subprime mortgage crisis. Searby is with a Florida research company that polled 500 Pennsylvanians who lost their homes to foreclosure and asked them why.
41% had a prime fixed loan, while only 8% had a subprime adjustable loan. The most significant finding is that those experiencing foreclosure experienced job loss in a combination. That is, they didn't just simply lose their job. They lost their job and then something else happened.
Something like medical bills, divorce, or a relative moving in. He says the message is that foreclosures are tied more closely to bad economic conditions than to the type of loan. Searby says he found the same results in Florida and Nevada, two states hit the hardest by the real estate crisis. According to a recent RealtyTrack report, in the first half of this year, the number of foreclosures went up in three-quarters of the largest U.S. metropolitan areas compared with a year ago.
And until we do something about it, we are going to be unable to resolve the current economic crisis.
Again, Cambridge attorney Paul Collier. He says foreclosures not only hurt millions of individual homeowners, they destabilize neighborhoods and drag down housing prices. Collier says federal initiatives that encourage banks to rework loans and avoid foreclosures are too weak because they're basically voluntary. But he says it doesn't have to be that way. Collier points out that in the wake of the 1930s depression, some states enacted tough measures to compel banks to lower monthly payments, and that dramatically reduced foreclosures.
States like Kansas and Iowa simply adopted mandatory mediation. That is, every lender had to sit in a room with a professional mediator and a homeowner and discuss modification of that loan. And foreclosures went down within 20 months of the passage of that bill by 94%.
In the absence of that kind of legislation, it might help if more Americans facing foreclosure knew about state and federal programs that could help them, programs that provide incentives to rework loans and lower monthly payments. But Joel Searby, who did the polling on those facing foreclosure in Pennsylvania, found that a majority of those surveyed didn't know how or where to get help.
There's no doubt that there's been a disconnect between what the federal government and state governments have been offering and what these folks who are experiencing foreclosure are needing.
So until that changes, or until the economy dramatically improves, the number of foreclosures will likely continue to rise in the months ahead. Anthony Brooks, NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Michelle Norris. We literally do not have enough time to recount all of the Anthony Horowitz books and screenplays for both television and the movies. But for our series, Thrill to Death, we'll stick to his thrillers, and specifically the books that chronicle a skateboard-riding spy for the British Secret Service, a plucky teenager named Alex Rider. The Alex Rider series almost rivals Harry Potter in the hearts and minds of young adults worldwide. And like Harry Potter, the series has legions of adult fans. Well, Anthony Horowitz joins me now from London to talk about that series. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, Michelle.
You know, at one point, a school librarian was trying to explain to me why your books were so popular or just how popular they were. And she pulled a few out of the stacks in her library, and they were well-loved. They were beaten up, and the covers were sort of torn back. Why do you think children, boys in particular, love these books?
Well, first of all, let me say that I do love it when I'm signing books and a kid brings along a book that is completely battered and it's been in the bath and it's got coffee stains all over it. You know, I think that's really great. You know, it's more fun in a way than seeing them crisp and new. Why do the kids have this passion for these books? I suppose it's partly down to the character. I mean, Alex was created at exactly the right time. This sort of very alienated but attractive and heroic young guy who somehow manages to survive on his own wits against all the adults. I think that's very much how young people feel these days, and so it was exactly the right time for it. But I'd say the other thing about the books is that they're very, very accessible. You know, when I write a sentence, a paragraph, a chapter, I'm always remembering that, you know, that kids have lots and lots of other things to do, so I reach out, I grab them, I hook them, I hold them, I keep the pace moving as fast as I possibly can, and maybe that's another reason why the books have had the success, you know, both in the UK and in the USA, but they have.
Now, there's a lot of suspense in these books. They move very quickly, and sometimes they're a little bit spooky. A typical Alex Rider reader is younger and has maybe been introduced to some scary themes, but how do you find the right balance for a young reader so the books are scary enough to get their juices flowing, but not so scary that they have nightmares and wake up screaming for mom and dad?
Well, Michelle, I'm very proud of the fact that in the sort of 15, 20 years that I've been writing children's books, I have never yet had a complaint, not from a parent, about, you know, levels of violence or levels of fear. There's got to be violence in the books. There's got to be threat. There's got to be danger. You've got to feel that Alex might not even survive the book. But at the same time, it can't be so horrible, so dark and so unpleasant that it upsets the readers or, you know, gives them nightmares. That's not what I'm in the game to do. And I should say that as the books have continued, they've become a little more demanding each time. If you start at Stormbreaker or Point Blank, they're very, very easy reads. They're very light. By the time you get to the more sort of recent ones, Crocodile Tears, Snakehead, and coming up next year's Scorpio Rising, the very last one in the series, I am aware that the books are more demanding, but I think and I hope that my readers have grown with me.
You turned to storytelling at a very young age as a way to help escape what sounds like a somewhat unhappy childhood. Do you find yourself drawing on the young Anthony Horowitz to help you write about Alex Rider?
I think the honest truth is that the day I stopped drawing on the young Anthony Horowitz was the day I became successful as a writer. Because a lot of my early books do very much use elements of my childhood and play over the fact that I was brought up in a very strange, unemotional family and I went to a very horrible school. And I write about that in a humorous way and an entertaining way because I've never been one to sort of try and sort of seek therapy through writing or whatever. But the day that I created Alex Rider was the day I created somebody who was utterly alien to me, who was fitter, smarter, better looking and just better equipped in every sense of for life than I had ever been. I mean, almost a kid that I wished I had been rather than the kid I was. And so the moment that he sprang onto the page for me in Stormbreaker was the moment that my fortunes turned and my sales began to add those zeros.
Where did Alex Rider come to you? How did he arrive in your psyche?
I'd had all these books I'd written, like 15 or 20 books, and they'd done pretty well by any standards, but not really well, not spectacularly well. after these books, I was always searching, what could I do next? What could I do that was different? And I remembered seeing the James Bond movies when I was a kid and how much I had loved them in the early days of Sean Connery. You know, you've mentioned that I didn't have a great childhood, but that event once a year, going to this movie and escaping into this extraordinary world, was in many respects the high point for me. As time had gone on, I just felt that James Bond was getting too old. And it had long occurred to me that Bond had lost his way, and that it would be so much better. Just this simple thought. Wouldn't it be great if Bond was a teenager? So cut forward now to 15 books later, and that thought comes into my head again, and I began to plan Stormbreaker, and that was the book that did everything for me.
The Alex Rider series was supposed to end in 2009, but fan outcry seemed to change your mind. And now you're at work on what is supposed to be the last book in this series. Is it truly the last book? Is there still room for appeal?
Michelle, I can tell you without any doubt at all that there is no way forward. The book is, without any question, the end of a long journey that I've been taking. And I have to tell you that it makes me very sad to think that. I wrote the last words of it a few nights ago, in fact, and sat there looking at it and thought, goodness, have you really done this? That makes 9 in the series, and then that is it. And it makes me sad, but I've really believed this, that it's best to quit while you're ahead. Don't go on writing formulaic books simply to make money for your publishers and for yourself and to supply, as it were, a market. I like to think that each book, in its own way, has been as good as or better than the one before, and I'm happy to quit on a high note with a body of work which I will look on and feel is about as perfect as it could have been, and not to write that one book that sort of spoils it.
Can you do a favor for me? Can you take me inside your den or your office where you were writing and describe for me what it was like to write those last words?
I went to Orford to write those last words. I have a little tiny house on a river. It has the most spectacularly beautiful view. And I was sitting up on the top floor and the sun was setting and the river and the sky turned to blood. I mean, they really do. The colours in Suffolk are extraordinary. You get the wind all the way from Siberia. And the clouds were just gently scudding across my vision, and everything is flat. Suffolk has no hills. And I sat there at the window, and I knew what was going to happen at the end. I'd left the paragraphs, the final paragraphs, until I was there. It's my favourite place in the world. And I wrote them, and I knew I'd done it correctly, and that the words were the words I wanted. I sat back, and as I sat back, literally, the round sun, which was a red burning disc, touched the edge of Orford Ness, just behind the lighthouse. And I just thought to myself, yes, you've done it exactly right. You've timed it exactly right, Anthony. That is the end.
Boy, I want to ask you about the end, what happened, but I know you won't tell me.
It ends with hope. The children's author has one duty in life, I believe, and that is always to write with hope. If you're young and you have, you know, everything in front of you, it is not the job of somebody like me to come along and say, actually, life is awful and, you know, get used to it. It is a dark book and is in many ways a sad book, but I think it ends with hope.
Anthony Horowitz, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. All the best to you.
Thank you very much.
Anthony Horowitz. He's the author of several thrillers for young adults and not so young adults, including the Alex Rider series. Last month in our Killer Thrillers poll, we asked you, our listeners, to help us pick the 100 most pulse-quickening thrillers ever written. It's been a cliffhanger, but the suspense is finally over. You can find the final list of winning thrillers in the summer books section of our website, npr.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.